No excuses, no excuses, no excuses. What is a no excuses school? What does it look like inside a no excuses school? We will find out from Jim Horn, who has studied and wrote a book about these types of schools. Our activist of the week blogs about her experience as a no excuses teacher. Matt Damon's mom checks in. We will have a moment of zen and update you on trending education news. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk. With Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Jed Hopkins. It's time to take a look at the top trending news stories in education. Number one.
Jed, you heard of opt out? Now get ready. Opt in.
Opt in.
Opt in. It's the new movement sweeping America. In protest to opt out, a lot of the reform effort groups, the people that support testing, have literally created a campaign called opt in. Or if you see it other places, say yes to the test.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You want to take this as funny, right? And
it's actually a good thing because it shows that the opt-out movement has had some traction and now they're having to do this.
Exactly. And that's the reality of what we want to point out here is how frightened must the reformers be that they've put together an opt-in movement. In fact, they're saying say yes to the test. I've been in and I hate to admit this, but I've had a Twitter battle lately with some of these guys that have declared that I am on the wrong side of civil rights, equating taking the test with civil rights.
You know, the argument that preserving civil rights through the use of testing as though that was the way to do it, that's a really dangerous fallacy.
Number two.
Creative writing professor Alan Erickson is engaging in innovative assessment. He is taking his worst students and giving them false hope. Jed, from The Onion.
Well, you know, the point of education is just to make you feel good, right?
Yeah, and this is what Alan is doing. He has said that every student is worth his time. So all students who can't write, he spends hours giving them lots of feedback, false hope about how they may one day be a writer, knowing full well that their writing sucks.
Well, that must give him quite a lot to do.
He's a very busy man.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk.
The concept of no excuses schools is picking up momentum. Is this a good thing? Joining us now is a man who has taken an in-depth look into these schools and has written a book about it. The author of Work Hard, Be Hard, Journeys Through No Excuses Teaching, Jim Horn joins us now. Jim, let's start by defining what exactly is a no excuses school.
Well, a no excuses school is, well, specifically speaking, is a school, usually a charter school, that is based upon certain, what they refer to as high expectations. It's an idea that came out looking at no excuses and where it came from. I went back and looked at the term itself, and what I found out was that it came out of the broken windows theory, which generally was in circulation during the 1980s, and then Rudy Giuliani made it famous when he was mayor of New York City. And to give you an analogy of how to think about it, Giuliani started these privately run shelters. They were publicly funded, privately run. And one of the reasons that they were privately run is so he could institute policies that wouldn't generally be allowed by public authorities. So they were very draconian. They had, you might say, very high expectations of those people who chose to come to be in those more, shall we say, safe and well-organized shelters. And the shelters themselves were advertised as being shelters of choice. So if people didn't want to go along with the rules, they could simply go back to the dangerous and malignantly neglected public shelters that they were trying to escape from. So no excuses schools follow a similar idea because they're advertised as schools of choice and they have a general philosophy of promoting strict adherence to the rules and that there is no excuse for failure regardless of what people might tell you. There is no excuse, whether it's poverty related, whether there's a disadvantage or anything else. Schools and students really have no excuse, and if failure is the result, then it's the failure of the individual rather than any failure of the no excuses school itself.
So when I get in there, if I'm a student, then what you're saying is that I, you know, if I stub my toe, if my father died, if I'm hungry, if I'm sick, and I say, teacher, I don't feel good today, the teacher's response and or the motto of the place is, get over it and get to work then, buddy.
Yeah, and, you know, students and parents sign contracts that they will abide by the rules, and if they're unwilling to do that, then they're always welcome to return to the malignantly neglected public schools that many of these parents were trying to find a better choice for. But the choice that they're being offered is a false choice because it's the only one available outside the public schools, which are generally suffering from underfunding and a lot of other issues related to poverty.
When I get into a no excuses school, what's it like for a student, at least according to your book and the people you talk to?
I talked to 25 former no excuses teachers. Most of them were KIPP teachers.
KIPP is Knowledge is Power. That's the private charter chain?
Yeah, the private charter chain is the largest one in the U.S. It has 183 schools, about 70,000 students now. To give you an economic note here, 70,000 students would account for about $500 million in public funds that KIPP is taking in each year. Because as we know, charter schools are, after all, public schools in the fact that they receive public funding.
They're publicly funded.
They're publicly funded, but that's where the public aspect ends.
So let's get one thing straight. When we call a public charter school, what we're saying is they're publicly funded.
They're publicly funded and privately governed. They're governed by a CEO and the CEO-appointed board. In the case of KIPP, it's a foundation that's been established. It's located in San Francisco, California, and they're sort of the home office for the KIPP schools. Even though there's a lot of autonomy within the schools themselves to make their own decisions, those decisions are made by the CEO or the school leader, who is responsible for putting together a board that governs the school, and they pretty much act as rubber stamps for the CEO, for the school leader.
You have 20-some no-excuse teachers that you talk to, and so what are they telling us about the inside workings of no-excuse charter schools?
Really, the core of the book is about 8 chapters where I sort of dissect my hundreds of pages of interview transcripts and try to organize that data in around questions that I ask the former teachers. Teachers, just to give you an idea of how they describe their experience, not everything was entirely negative about their experiences. Many of them had formed friendships with teachers at these schools. Many of them had encountered teachers who were working their guts out to make it work. But generally speaking, the words that were used to describe their experiences, which generally last 2 years, that's the average lifespan of a no-excuses teacher, was extremely discouraging, terrifying, draining. One teacher said it was like sprinting a marathon for 2 years. Oppressive, hell. One teacher described KIPP schools as a concentration camp. The word pressure cooker was used a great deal. One former teacher described it as a soul-crushing place. Another called it the most horrible experience of her life. The worst years teaching ever, and probably one I heard more than a couple of times, was something you would not wish on your worst enemy.
When you try to get information from these no-excuses schools themselves, their lack of forthcoming and ability to give you and grant you permission to their sites was not very favorable, to say the least?
Yeah. When I set out to do this book, my intent was to give voice to those former teachers who have worked in this environment, to let them tell their stories. It was never my intention to do an ethnography, that is, go into KIPP schools for an extended period of time. But in 2013, I thought it would be good to visit a KIPP school. I'd visited a no-excuses charter school in Memphis that was based upon the KIPP model and saw many of the same things that teachers had talked to me about, because of these interviews went from 2012 to 2015. And when I approached KIPP in Memphis, I hesitated, and then within a couple of weeks they said no, at which point I contacted Jay Matthews, who writes for the Washington Post and has always been a KIPP fan.
Yeah, big KIPP cheerleader.
He wrote a book called Work Hard, Be Nice, which is the KIPP motto, which is what the title of my book is taking off from. And Jay contacted the home office of KIPP. KIPP, and they said that no, they would not allow me to visit a KIPP school. Jay had a response to the book. He did a two-part, what he calls the review, which appeared in the Washington Post the day the book was published, February 28th. He insinuated that these are old stories and that no one has come forward to verify these interviews and that everyone remains anonymous. And with the exception of one teacher, they did ask to remain anonymous. And the reason that they did was for fear of reprisals from these organizations that are very powerful in terms of their influence. And believe me, it wasn't the easiest thing in the world to find a publisher who would even take this book for what I would say would be similar reasons, although it was never admitted.
We are talking to James Horn, and this is Busted Pencils Radio, Fully Leaded Education Talk.
Yeah, Jim, I'm really intrigued and really disturbed by everything you've been saying. How open are these schools to having parents come in?
As far as I know, they make a general invitation to anyone who wants to visit. The teachers I talked with found that parents were certainly not barred from the schools, but they weren't encouraged. They were encouraged to be supportive of the school program and what the school was trying to accomplish. But in terms of participating in the school, you know, that's left to what KIPP refers to as the professionals who know what they're doing. Even though many of these teachers are the least experienced teachers you could imagine, many of them come from Teach for America. KIPP and its emulators couldn't continue to operate if it were not for a continuing supply of beginning teachers that Teach for America supplies. About 30% of their teachers come from TFA.
Can I complain if I don't like what's happening with my child in a no-excuses charter school?
Yes, you can complain, at which point you're invited to return to the school you came from. You know, if you can't abide by the contract, which stipulates the five pillars on which the school operates, the principles of that they're operated on, which are high expectations, leadership, freedom to make decisions based upon the school's interest, and following the rules and supporting the school and these kind of things, then you're disinvited. The book ends with two stories from two different parents, both African-American parents. One parent who pulled her daughter out of a KIPP school after she finished middle school, and she didn't want her to go to the KIPP high school. This story was originally published on Norm Scott's blog, and Education Online is the name of the blog. And she points out in there that children call KIPP, K-I-P-P, the Kids in Prison Program. You know, part of it is, of course, jokingly, but it's the darkest kind of humor. Because in many ways, KIPP does resemble more a penal institution than an educational institution. To get back to your parents visiting and their parents' encouragement to visit, one former teacher did tell me that in her school there was a schedule that they followed called Visitors in Building Schedule, VIB, the VIB schedule, so that when potential contributors or other people from the community, politicians, etc., were visiting the school, they went on a schedule where they were on three-hour blocks so that there were no interruptions during that time, no class changes, no opportunity for children to act out or anything to happen that couldn't be controlled within the individual classrooms. The school had identified about 30 of the children who were most likely in the school to cause problems. And during those VIB days, those three-hour blocks, those children were taken from their classes and put in the basement under the supervision of a teacher until the visitors left the building. When we visit, or when someone was to visit a KIPP school, it's very hard to tell what's going on because they're very tightly controlled in terms of the picture that they present for the public's consumption. The corporate reform movement is totally behind this kind of school for the poor.
Well, the book is Work Hard, Be Hard, Journeys Through No Excuses Teaching. Jim, on behalf of Jed, I want to say thanks for the afternoon and giving us some time.
Oh, sure thing, Tim. And nice to meet you, Jed.
I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say about No Excuses Schools.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Let's think for a minute first about this idea of no excuses. What does it really mean? You know, this word excuse has been around now. It's been part of the Ed Reform movement. And I remember the first time the first person said to me when I was at Lesley University, poverty is not an excuse. And I turned around puzzled. because it was the first time I'd heard it, because I didn't understand that. What do you mean poverty is not an excuse? Well, first of all, who's looking for excuses? Doesn't an excuse imply that someone's trying to get away with something? Or, you know, I expect something of you, and you better come through no matter what. There's no excuse. Even the very idea of that, to my thinking, does that mean a child comes to school and hasn't had breakfast or is homeless? Or hasn't seen a parent because the parent had to leave for work at 4 a.m. and the kid got ready on her own. You know, and so we're going to get high grades anyway, even though we don't know, we don't have health care and we didn't have food. And so there's no excuse for those things. We're going to just buckle down and study these Common Core standards as if we didn't just come out of that situation. The very assumption about this idea of excuses is offensive to me. But it's a widespread idea now. Many people use it. We have no excuses schools. And that means you go to school and you learn all these standards. You learn all these requirements. There's no excuse for not learning them. You're all equal. This is how we're closing the achievement gap here. We're all equal. Forget it that you came from a home with a wealthy home and you come from a poor home. Doesn't matter. No excuse. You're all going to buckle down. And along with that, we have to have also no excuses for any bad behavior. So you have to walk down the hall silently, and you have to have your hands folded behind your back and can't touch another person and so forth. Because there's this whole set of behavioral requirements that seem to accompany the academic requirements of these no excuses schools. And I realize when I think about that the very assumption about who human beings are and who children are and how they learn would be different from somebody who adhered to a no-excuses philosophy versus somebody who adhered to a more humanitarian or child-centered philosophy. Because I think with the no-excuses idea, I think it's basically aligned with that empty vessel idea. Like, you kids don't know anything, and I have to tell you all these facts and all this knowledge that comes from the world. I have to pour it into you because you have nothing in your empty head. And furthermore, I have to teach you good behavior because I can't count on you to have any on your own. Versus a more, what you might say, constructivist idea, or an idea that children, young people, participate in learning. They have an active role to play. And that when they learn, it's because they're interacting between what's inside them, the ideas they have in their heads, the feelings they have in their hearts, the knowledge that they're building little by little within them. That's interacting with the experiences that we provide in schools. And that's what knowledge, that's what real learning comes from. That's what real knowledge is built from, is from this active, interactive relationship between the learner and the environment. And those are two fundamentally different ways of looking at learning. And I think this whole no excuses thing is a new version of a very old idea about social transmission of knowledge and empty vessels and blank slates and all those things we've known for a long time were one way to view human beings and learning. But I don't agree with that. And there's no evidence. If you look at child development or developmental psychology, you see that there's the participation of the infant from birth. The active, engaged learner is taking initiative to engage with the environment and learn from the first moments of life. So I think it's really very, very sad. No excuses schools have to depend on coercion. They have to depend on suppression. They have to depend on compliance and obedience. And these are things that will deaden learning and deaden children's souls and spirits. And hopefully, I always keep hoping that even kids who go to schools like this, they're going to find their will and their spirit from within, and they're going to come back.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Let's bring in our activist of the week. She began her teaching career as an educator at a no excuses school in New York City. She left that school and is now a fourth grade teacher at a public school in Maine. You can find her blogging at emilytalmadge.com. Emily, what is it like to be a no excuses teacher?
In a word, it was horrific. I had taught in a regular public school for 3 years prior and had really no idea about these charter schools. I had kind of like heard all the hoopla and the propaganda and the Waiting for Superman. So I decided to try a year at one of these schools. And within just a few weeks, I realized that I had made a really, really big mistake. And I was miserable. I mean, whatever you have heard is true. I mean, it really felt like I was more of a prison guard. I know that sounds strong, but I felt like that was more of what I was doing, was like nonstop enforcing of rules and catching kids and very scripted lessons. It was really demoralizing, and I barely hung on for the year that I was there.
It's just within the past couple of weeks that there was a pretty shocking video released from a No Excuses school where a teacher was berating that student. I mean,
I didn't treat the kids that way, I don't think.
We were not accusing you of treating kids that way.
To be fair, though, there were times when I would kind of watch myself from the outside and be like, I can't believe I'm doing this. But when I saw that video, my first thought was like, yup, that looks very familiar. And in fact, I watched it a couple times and then had to stop because it brought back like PTSD from what we experienced. So for me, when I saw that video was very accurate, because I remember reading some comments and people saying like, well, you know what like the context was, this might have been taken out of, no, that was not taken out of context. What that teacher did in that moment was classic at one of these schools. I mean, it wasn't like nonstop berating these kids, but that kind of behavior that teacher showed would have been normal. I mean, I saw that kind of thing all the time and have some pretty, pretty awful memories, to the point where you know, the longer I worked there, the more I thought, oh, my God, how is this happening and how do people not know about this? And, you know, I kept thinking, like, this is the kind of thing that, like, history is going to look back on and be like, oh, my gosh, how did people let this happen without stopping it? Which was why you've interviewed Jim Horn, I think.
Right.
When I found his website, it was like, it was just such a relief, because it was like, thank God there's at least somebody out there that's digging this stuff up and putting it out there. And because it was really like, I was in New York City and I lived in Maine, but I remember I'd come home and try to explain to people what was happening. And you could tell they just like either didn't really believe me or didn't quite get it. But I really was like, no, this is happening to kids like right now. And I know this sounds extreme, this word, but like the word slavery, I know that sounds extreme, but like it came to mind quite a bit, like this sense of like young people being completely taken advantage of and treated like dirt for the benefit of these, you know, hedge fund investors and these charter chains. That to me, it was just so clear that it was not benefiting the kids, and if anything, they were harming them. So I know that sounds strong, but that was kind of what went through my mind at the time. So
I sense you are a good person. I don't know
but
I just feel that you are a good person. And you mentioned that you watched Waiting for Superman. I want to ask you, what motivated you? What was in your mind? What were you thinking you were going to do in this new role?
Well, you know, I had kind of gotten this mentality of that closing the achievement gap was what my mission was, as this young white teacher who'd come out of, you know, liberal arts college, and that was my goal. And I had heard that these No Excuses charter schools were closing the achievement gap. And, you know, since that was my goal and these schools were doing it, you know, that was my kind of saw that as, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be working to do this.
Very commendable.
Well, that's what I thought. And I think a lot of young kids kind of get pulled in. And then all of a sudden you end up in this place where there's so much pressure. But you know, you get pumped up to think that, you know, this is going to sound strong again, but kind of that white savior complex, you know, they really do play that. You know, there's a strong sense of like, you owe this, you know, and so I think a lot of young people like I did, you know, go into it thinking that we're doing what's right and what's really good for these kids. And then you start to look and think, oh, my God, that's not what this is at all.
Right. So there's a whole psychological dynamic at play here that plays with you, played with you.
Talked about James Horn. In fact, you are one of the informants in James Horn's new book, The Work Hard, Be Hard, Journeys Through No Excuses Teaching. You are our activist of the week because, first of all, you have the courage to speak about what it was like to be in a No Excuses school, and you've gone on record and talked about this. But now we can find you at emilytalmadge.com. Mm-hmm. And what are we going to find on emilytalmadge.com?
Well, so the short story is that I taught in New York City, then left this charter and moved back home to Maine, where I'm from, and kind of mistakenly thought that I had left all of this madness behind and was safe and was free from all this. But then, you know, it turned out that I was wrong, and that, in fact, the state of Maine in particular has and is being used kind of as a lab. So we're a big state, but very spread out, very rural. So we've kind of for a long time been sort of a zone to try out these new reform ideas. And one of them in particular that I've kind of been pushing out there really hard is this competency proficiency-based education thing. We're here in Maine, we're the only state with this proficiency-based diploma, and it's really like upending our schools from top to bottom. So about a year ago, I started to kind of dig and found out that all of the networks and foundations and corporations pushing this are the same ones that are proponents of charters and that are pushing, you know, the Common Core and the annual testing. So I started a blog about a year ago to try to get people to see, I guess, that it's not just testing that's a problem, and it's not even just the charter movement and the testing movement, but that there's other policies that are kind of coming at us fast and furious, especially with the ESSA reauthorization. So that's kind of what my blog is now, following what's happening with this sort of, I call it like next-gen ed reform, because my personal impression, you know, personally, I was really excited at first that they were sunsetting No Child Left Behind and that this whole new bill was coming, and I was riding the wave, like, oh my gosh, things are finally going to get better. And then I started to do my own research and actually go into the legislation myself and put things together, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a trap. There's so much in here that maybe even worse than what we've gotten. So it's kind of hard to be piecing that together while at the same time, you know, getting, you know, messages from our union leadership and things like that, like, right, you know, championing what a great change this is going to be, while here in Maine, our schools are really being turned upside down. So that's kind of been my mission.
EmilyTalmadge.com is the blog. Make sure you check it out. Emily, thanks for your time. Jed, what do we tell Emily?
Emily, keep busting those pencils.
Time now for our weekly tribute to the legendary Howard Zinn, a quote that certainly applies to today's discussion. Here is your moment of Zinn.
The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
Want more Busted Pencils? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also, log on to BustedPencils.com to keep up with trending news, hear parts of the show, and nominate an activist of the week. For Jed Hopkins, I'm Tim Slecker, and thanks for Busting Pencils.